You're listening to a Bucks Plus audio production on the Bucks Plus Network.
Your weekly pulse on the Milwaukee Bucks, straight from a Bucks legend. This is Here District with Marcus Johnson, alongside his son and 1995 NCAA champion, Chris. Here's MJ.
All right, welcome everybody to Here District, the fantastic voyage as we follow the comings and goings and doings of the Milwaukee Bucks. And man, has it been some excitement. A whole lot of stuff has been going on, a lot of movement with this Bucks team. Yeah. And I'm liking what I'm seeing. I'm Marcus Johnson, the captain of this vessel. My first mate, Chris Johnson, the only father and son tandem in the history of NCAA basketball to win a national championship at the same school, UCLA. What's up, Chris? How you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. Doing great. So this is a fun time of year. Summer League has officially started.
Yep.
In Las Vegas, the whole Bucks contingent of
they pulled up deep out there.
Players, coaches, personnel, front office.
That's how you got to roll up.
Chefs. I mean, that's my one detriment is that all the good cooking chefs are no longer here in Milwaukee. They're in Las Vegas now. So
it's so wild how everything is centered around your meal and your eating at the Bucks.
Come on.
That's nuts. I mean, everything centers around that, MJ. Yeah,
I don't know, but it's always a taste of the cuisine.
I see why I grew up with weight problems. Like living in a household where food and the thought of food and what we're gonna eat. You're tripping on the dude being in Las Vegas.
Man.
This is crazy. This is why I used to be a big guy.
Two of my favorite chefs too. I mean, the blueberry pancakes, no more. I mean, the afternoon man. But I did have a swan song, French toast that the lady chef hooked up the other day. That was outstanding.
Powdered sugar? Was this some powdered?
No, she was cooking it on the grill. I'm like, what's that? She's like, that's French toast. I'm like, okay, you got enough for OG
such a
here.
Charmer, MJ the charmer.
She's like, sure. I got how many pieces you want? Two, three? Just give me two. They were huge too. She cut them in half, man, and I put that syrup on there. Just sopped up that syrup. They were off the hook. But listen, so Summer League started. Watching the first game, Doc Rivers, great interview that he did with Steve Smith and Chris Miles for NBA TV.
What's the one area, we're not even talking about a player, that you want to see the Milwaukee Bucks improve in?
Or pace.
Okay, playing a little faster.
Yeah, we got to play faster. Defensively, though we started out slow, and then by the end of the year, we became a really solid defensive team. We want to pick up where we left off defensively. And, you know, the second half of the year, when I put the ball in Giannis' hands, you know, we did it by default. I'd love to say I'm this genius. And I thought, hey, let's play Giannis at the point guard spot. I can tell you when I brought it up with our coaches, they thought I had lost my mind. And when I brought it with Giannis, he thought I had lost my mind. Because he already has the ball in his hands. But, like, having him bring it up every time, it eliminated. You know how the whole league right now, everybody's fresh in the ball? Nobody's fresh in Giannis.
Nobody.
And so it allowed us, even against Indiana, to bring the ball up pressure-free. You know, the most dangerous guy on our team had the ball already. And when you put shooting around that, and that's where the Gary Trents and A.J. Greens, like I think both of those guys are going to have breakout years for us. That's where that all came into play. So I want to pick up from that and build on.
Talked about him playing kind of a point forward role. And as the guy who came up with that term, invented that term. I'm not the original point forward. You can go all the way back to Maurice Stokes and Rick Barry and guys like that and Robert Reed and Johnny Johnson, blah, 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 blah. But I'm the first guy to ever utter those words, point forward. Came out of my mouth first in 1984 in a playoff series in May against the New Jersey Nets back in the day. But my point is this. Doc said, Chris, forget about point forward. Giannis was going to be the point guard. The ball is going to be in his hands, and some great numbers here that our producer, Dylan Carter, came up. In 28,000 career minutes, Giannis has played, and I don't know how they come up with this, but this is a stat that's on in the books. Giannis has actually played the point guard position from the one for a total of 4% of the minutes of his career.
Yeah.
4%. So your thoughts on point Giannis?
I mean, when you look at the current roster structure, Giannis, the ball in Giannis's hands is your best bet. There's no offense meant to Dame, but for my liking and what I saw last season, he brought up the ball too slowly. I never was a big fan of that. Now, I don't know, Giannis is going to obviously not go full speed all the time, but I love Giannis's ability to put pressure on defenses.
Yeah.
More so than Dame. Giannis is a different breed. Now, he doesn't have the three that Dame had, but at that position, you got to make some decisions and you got to make some choices. And if you surround Giannis with a roster of guys that can knock down shots, attack closeout, make plays in space, you guys are going to have a hard time. It's going to be a headache. I think this is a new brand of basketball that Doc is sort of, hey, you know, it's kind of, you know, Doc is, you got to try it. I mean, you got to go for something. You got it's just, he's at a point, I think, where this type of move makes a ton of sense. You can't get the Bucks Nation too pissed off at you for putting Giannis at the point because, you know, how can Bucks Nation be mad at you for this? You're putting the ball in the hands of the man. Who's going to put the ball in the hands of, KPJ?
But my thing is hasn't Giannis had the ball? I mean, he led the league in usage rate like a couple of years ago, like about 37. He's always up around 35 to 38, 39% usage rate. Maybe a tick lower last year because of Dame the last couple of years. But he's always had, you know, he's always had the ball in his hands. Now, the one thing Doc did say, and it's to your point, when he was asked, like point blank directly by Chris Miles, what needs to change for this Bucks team this season compared to last season, this coming season, Doc said pace. Yeah. He said, we've got to play faster.
That's what I'm talking about.
And he was trying to cajole these guys. You like that word, cajole these guys into playing faster last season. You don't like
you
cajole.
Can't.
But
the sweetness of Dame bringing it up. Bounce, let it bounce. Like, no, I'm not knocking Dame. But that, you know, Dame, that's a rhythm thing. Like, MJ, you know what I'm talking about. Like, you saw it last year. You saw the difference when certain lineups were in and just the way the ball would hop around and move. And I think that that's going to be an emphasis and the biggest difference. I don't think sticking is no longer going to be a thing. Giannis at the one dominating the ball, I think, is the best bet. I love it. Let other guys D and knock down threes. I mean,
And to your point, Giannis averaged a career high 6.5 assists last year. But check this number out. In 16 regular season games without Dame Lillard, Giannis averaged pretty much 8 assists a game. You know, and that's not without really having a mindset like I'm the point guard. I'm the you know, if he goes into it with that mindset, 8 assists, he could boost that up to close to double digits in assists. And if he does that, we're talking about averaging. It's something you've talked about, averaging a triple double or getting close to it for the season, which would put him right. That would have to elevate him, you know, from number 3 MVP discussion to top 2, I would think. Depending on the Bucks, Shea and Jokic is going to be tough to crack, right?
I don't think it's about Shea and Jokic. I think it's really about this weird Bucks bias that the national media has, whether it be whatever it is. I don't know, but it's something strange. Like, we can no longer deny this. This is not a figment of our imagination.
Well, small market bias. I mean, I've been around. I mean, it's been here since the 70s.
I've never been on this side. So you grew up in this. Yeah. You know, I lived it. I've never seen this like this, and it's really legitimate. I can't believe the stuff and just how the reports are coming out, how differently a Jokic, you know, when Kroenke's on talking about Jokic potentially not signing for whatever and how that's going to look, and then, you know, how they – just don't cover it the same way.
Yeah,
and then everything about Giannis is just, it seems like they're trying to push Giannis to make a move to a bigger market.
Yeah, yeah.
Everyone. And so that's the part that I don't like about it. Anyway, that's just my thing. But back to the point.
It's relevant. It's relevant because, I mean, to your point, hold your thought. Make sure you keep that thought in mind. Yeah. But even the Miles Turner narrative that shifted – you know, that shifted midstream from the top free agent, one of the most desirable free agents out there, top
incredible.
2 or 3 in rim protection stats the last 5 or 6 years, 39.6% from the 3-point line. And Now, all of a sudden, he's not the second coming of Kareem. I don't know. He's no Bob Lanier. I don't know why you guys, they didn't say Bob Lanier, but I just threw that out because he's a former teammate.
But it's the sentiment.
It shifted. It shifted like, so what? Who's going to get him the ball? So what?
That's
but
crazy.
It's to your point, that's that small market buy. They want Giannis. They're trying to talk Giannis into New York, into Golden State, into Chicago, into one of these big markets. Like, let him be, man. Let us have some nice things here in Milwaukee for a while. And if this young man wants to spend the entirety of his career, and shout out to John Horst, because I had no idea what he could do, if he could do, what's available. Now all of a sudden I read the Bucks side Miles Turner. I'm like, what the? Then the next thing I read, the Bucks stretch out Dame Lillard. And that took some cojones to make that move the way he did. So, I mean, go ahead, finish your point.
No, shout out John Horst, definitely made some moves. My point was just how, you know, we lose Brooke. Now Jericho Sims is going to be counted on to bring some athleticism and some stuff above the rim. Think about this. Imagine if Jericho Sims and Giannis can get some chemistry, develop some chemistry on this lob work. You know, the record for lob points in the season was, I think, Lob City. I think they averaged like 13 points a game on lobs in 2014 with Giannis at the one and doggone Jericho in the dunker. Just imagine the possibilities. So that was something that I was looking at as well. And then also to my point, Ryan Rollins is going to have to do some handling. KPJ is going to have to do less handling and creating at the one. He only shouldered a 17.3% playmaking load last season, which was, you know, pretty, you know, I don't know, set 98th percentile for reserves. Can he handle 25% plus as a starter, or are we good with Ryan Rollins and Giannis splitting that position and then KPJ playing more of a creator off that wing, off the two? You know, how much of KPJ at the point? So these are just some things I was thinking about after I heard the Doc conversation. Because I really feel like they're going to lean all the way into this, and we're going to see a lot of creativity out of all this sets with Giannis with the ball.
Okay, so you mentioned Jericho Sims.
Right.
Have you seen the video of him shooting with his left hand?
So, yeah, he's been doing that apparently.
I didn't know if that was some reverse angle that was all out of whack, but he's actually shooting with this. I mean, they kind of looked at it and said, well, the numbers and the lettering is cool. So he's actually shooting with this. And so what the guy, I mean, I'm drawing a blank here, but you'll know him. LeBron's guy in Cleveland. He was with
Tristan
Thompson. He kind of went from a right hander to a left hander. I remember one of the Plumlee brothers started shooting free throws like with an opposite hand and had some success with that. But this is just a weird thing to me. Just watching him, you know, hit bucket after bucket. And I think his coach at Texas, Shaka Smart, who's now at Marquette, but even mentioned that you know, he was ambidextrous. You know, he was amphibious, but he was ambidextrous at Texas. And so the Bucks are going to, I guess, lean on that and see what happens. That's going to be fascinating for me to see him do something like that. So.
1.28 points per possession as a role man, that number can increase. I'm excited to see what he adds to the table. A lefty, an ambidextrous finisher, you know, that just gives you options. It gives you options on pick and roll, on finishing, what you can do.
Yeah, there was a play that Dame had a block on Siakam maybe in the playoffs. Dame blocked Siakam. But if you look in the background, Jericho Sims is also pursuing that layup. He takes off from the dotted, and his head is about this high over the rim. It's just the most incredible, you know. And I'm watching Dame's block, and I'm looking behind him, and I see Jericho with his head like, well, you know, he's got nose rim level. And I'm just excited to see what he's going to bring to the table. Also, Doc talked about breakout seasons, and he talked about a couple of guys, Chris, that he thought were in store for breakout seasons. Gary Trent Jr. was one. Now, Gary Trent Jr., I mean, after a miserable start, and a lot of it had to do with some. I think it was some injury. It was hip injury. Something was going on with him at the start of the season that caused him to not knock down shots like he's capable of. But he still wound up shooting like 41%, 40% from the three, 43% over his last 25 games. So averaged 14 points per game during that stretch. What's a breakout season for Gary Tripp? What kind of numbers would you say define a breakout season for Gary Trent Jr. this year?
I mean, we're talking breakout. Isn't a dub a breakout season? Isn't 20 points per game breakout?
Or does he have that in him? A dub is not easy to get to average.
In today's NBA, I don't know. I think it's a lot easier than it was than when you were playing. And in the 90s, I think it's a lot easier. Now, look, I'm not trying to act like him averaging 20 points a game is just, you know, that's some, like, you know, easy task. But my point is, why would Doc say breakout? I think he might have something in store. More shots for Gary, more looks for Gary, more actions ran for Gary, more stuff for Gary. When you have a coach that believes in you and is talking about you and that's kind of, you know, singing your praises in the Summer League interview, there's something going on there. There's a belief there. There's a confidence there. And they're maybe a plan to increase his usage as far as getting him shots.
Yeah. And that'd be a good plan. And also, and we talked about this a lot, and the numbers bore it out. And this is, you know, when I was talking to my good friend Ed Waters, coach at Crenshaw High School, Maxine Waters' son, been best friends since seventh grade, but he was talking about analytics. So I was telling him how the eye test told me that triumvirate of Kevin Porter Jr., Gary Tritt Jr., and A.J. Green was really effective together, especially with Giannis. And then I just happened to go to Cleaning the Glass, my favorite site, to look up analytics. And Ben Falk runs that. But looked up their numbers, their on-court numbers with Giannis, and they were in the 90th percentile across the board, offensively and defensively. That was the shocker. Offensively, hitting shots, scoring points, all that good stuff. But defensively, they were in lockdown mode on the perimeter, those three guys. And then you watch them and the energy. And you talked about that. And that's what Kevin Porter Jr., Gary Tritt Jr., they got some dog in them, man. And A.J. also, they got some dog in them.
No, they do. They all have dog in them. And another guy I think that's probably the most underrated signing of the Bucks offseason is Gary Harris. Yeah. Gary Harris is a dog, too, defensively. You lose PC, who was 1.01 points per possession defensively in isolation. You bring in Harris, who's 0.83 in isolation defenders, and he can knock down.
Wait. Slow down. Pat Connaughton, his isolation defensive efficiency.
Per NBA advanced stats, PC, as an isolation defender.
Right.
1.01 points per possession.
That's solid. That's not terrible, right? I mean, it's okay, or is it? But I mean, I don't.
You know, versus the league average, I'm not sure, but I do. But Gary Harris was
0.83. Woo! Wow.
So, you literally 91st percentile. So you're picking up a guy who can lock up at a much different level. So that just adds on top of what you're talking about with this kind of group of perimeter wings. Now, I mean, that move is very underrated. I know people were kind of like Gary. People kind of like Gary Harris, whatever. I was like, let me look up Gary Harris's stuff. Let me look at him next to PC and see what's going on. What are we losing and what are we gaining? And that, to me, was the biggest thing.
How tall is Gary? About 6'3", 6'4", 6'5"?
6'5"?
Is he 6'5"? They give him 6'5"? I know they got this new measuring. I mean, he may have been 6'5" at one point, but I think now the new measurement is 6'4", which is good. That's like being 6'6". 5 years ago.
Yeah, he's 6'4".
You know, the 6'4" is like being, you know, 6'6", 6'6" and a half, you know, 10 years ago, you know. But 6'4", solid, strong, Izzo tough from Michigan State, Izzo tough. And you're talking about that 0.89 defensive efficiency in isolation and his 3-point shooting.
Yeah.
I mean, he's what, probably 38, 39, somewhere in there for his, I mean, That's a signing. Now, I think
he's 37. He's 37 for his career.
Which is solid. Yeah,
and you know, small sample size for last season, only in 15 minutes a game. But what matters is he's not going to play too much more than 15 minutes a game for the Bucks. So if he can come in and duplicate that type of production on the defensive end, last year he shot 35.6 from the three. Now, if you can get that up a little bit, which I think he will with this type of crew and the type of looks he'll get, more open looks because of Giannis and all the Bobby being on the block, drawing doubles, like, it's going to be a different look. He could be, you know, a pretty valuable guy coming off the bench. It's like a ninth, tenth guy. Think about it. Fit is everything. thing, and that's what Horst needs to get credit. The guys he brought in, they fit very well to the current structure, the current core of the Bucks got.
Chris Livingston looks really good right now. Just so 21 years old. He looks really good right now. I mean, just watching him, his confidence, some of the stuff he's doing offensively. He's always had the great energy defensively, rebounding, active. But offensively, Chris, he's starting to slow down and get a understanding of where his strengths are as an NBA player. And that could – this is a guy that LeBron and – what's LeBron's agent?
Rich
Paul. They made a special trip to Las Vegas, or were in Las Vegas, to see him play an AAU game when he was like 15, 16 years old. He's supposed to be the next LeBron coming out of Akron. So he's got he's got that weight, that pressure, one and done at Kentucky. He's just 21 years old. He looks good. But also, Chris, keep your eye on this young man, Carmack Ryan. Carmack Ryan is about a 6'5", 6'6", shooter. He had a great debut. Knocked down three or four early jumpers in Las Vegas in their first game against the Denver Nuggets. But just keep your eye on him. He's got a way about him that's like Sam Merrill-like. And some of these Duncan Robinson. He comes off of screens, Chris, like Duncan Robinson, or handoffs. And you know how Duncan Robinson pushes that ball out and creates 4 or 5 feet of separation before he gets into his shot. Carmack Ryan is out of that same mold, man. And keep your eye on him. Go ahead.
Let me ask you a question, MJ. How much do you put into summer league performances when you're evaluating whether or not a guy is going to be able to help the main roster? Like, what are you looking for? What are you looking at? What stands out about those two specifically that you feel like will give them a shot to make the main roster?
Well, just how comfortable they look doing what they do. You know, how comfortable they look going to their strengths. Now, if a guy's strength is shooting and he can't get his shot off in the summer league, he damn sure ain't gonna get his shot off in the NBA.
You know, we saw Wimby. So you're saying just shot off. You're not talking about hitting shots. Like when we see a Cooper Flagg go 5 for 21, does that hurt you as much? Because my thing is, okay, so he's missing shots. It's his first night. Everybody just – Wimby had a tough start to summer league, got dunked on, all kind of stuff. Gets to the NBA, transcended. So how do you, MJ, decide whether or not this guy is just a summer league dude or this guy – like I hear you, the way they do what they do, but how do we – like –
Look, man, look, I'm going to keep it a buck. I'm going to keep it 100. I mean, I saw Cooper Flagg, his first summer league game against the Lakers and Bronny. And I was not blown away. Not the fact that he struggled to hit shots, and he did a, you know, but they put the ball in his hands. He didn't have quite the. And look, he's what, 19 years old or whatever he is, one of the second youngest.
I think he's 18.
18.
Bro.
Second youngest NBA pick. But I was expecting. A little more explosion. I'm just saying explosion. He's explosive. Don't get me wrong. But in a crowd against contact, he wasn't able to get into domination mode in a crowd of physical players like I kind of had anticipated he'd be able to do. He's a good player. He's a really good player. Whether he's going to be this transformative, and look, he's 18 years old. So, you know, you got to factor, you know, that's crazy.
He's 18.
You got to factor that into the equation. But I don't know, man. So you think he's going to be a transformative Larry Bird level type all time
LeBron great.
You know,
maybe LeBron is a little bit too much just because
way too much.
But I always looked at Cooper kind of like as a LeBron, a younger LeBron. Everybody always gave me a hard time on Twitter because he doesn't even have no explosiveness. But I'm talking about more about how he goes about his business, how he plays the game, his skill set, the shots he takes. He has some brawn in him. But again, I think strength is also one of the biggest things, like, for everybody when they're coming into the league. Like, he needs to get with the NBA weightlifting for 3 months, and then after that, come fall, we'll be able to see truly who this guy is. That, like you say, the crowd. When you're in the crowd, not being able to jump through things, that's a strength issue. I think he's going to address that this summer.
Yeah, and it reminds me of some of the critiques that the ladies on the ladies' side with Caitlin Clark, in terms of what she was voted like as one of the ninth best players.
She was voted the ninth best guard
by the players. But they point to just the strength factor and getting, you know, and turnovers and pressure, how that flopping and all that stuff. And not to say Cooper's on that same page, but you know, wow. and I haven't made a definitive opinion. It's just my very first impression was like, he's not LeBron. LeBron averaged 20 points a game as a kid straight out of high school.
Yeah, we haven't seen Cooper. So you don't know what Cooper's going to average this year.
Yeah, you're right.
Getting some buckets, bro. Like, with the ball in your hands, life is different. Like they talk about on Gil's Arena all the time, like how salty those dudes are. When you get the ball, when you get the shots, yeah, when you are christened as the guy,
yeah,
you have a different existence. 19?
You factor in your maiden voyage, you know, all the hoopla, all the attention, all the focus, all the eyeballs are on you. You're going against Bronny and the Lakers, he's a Maine kid, a small town Maine dude, and I would imagine that there was a little bit of nerves and anxiety and anxiousness and all that good stuff that probably impacted how effective that he's going to be. My jury's still out. But I'm just giving you the first impressions. It wasn't like, oh my God, this guy here is second coming of whomever. So,
what were your first impressions on the Bucks' second round draft pick, Bogey?
Bogey, it's interesting. The Bucks are going to use this summer league to ascertain whether or not he's got what it takes to stay on the roster for the season, or does he need another year? He's only 19, turned 20. Cyrus's birthday on the 12th of July. My son Cyrus, they got the same birthday. So he'll turn, he's 20. He's basically, for all intents and purposes, just 20 years old. Again, jury's still out. I mean, he did some okay things, some good things, did some things that is going to need some work. But he's a young player. You expect that. I almost anticipate, and again, it's way too early. I haven't seen enough of him in summer league. It's still early in the process. But he could probably, my instincts, knee-jerk, kind of tells me that it wouldn't hurt him, even though he did average like 14 and 6 or 7 in the Adriatic League, and at the same age, Jokic averaged like 11 and 6. But it's all subject to change, Chris. If he gets comfortable, and same thing with Cooper Flagg, but if Bogey gets comfortable in the next few games that the Bucks are going to play in Las Vegas, I could see, just watching him going up and down in practice situations, the dude is good, man. He's talented. So I like him. He's got tremendous upside. But if you have the luxury of not needing him this year, you know, unless you feel like he's going to contribute in a valuable way, it's almost better, you know what I'm saying, if you let him go back and continue to get some seasoning, as we used to say. You know, Bogey and Tyler, you know, Tyler, this is a – he's young too. What is he, like 20, 21? Maybe, I don't even know if he's 21 yet.
Dude, yeah, Tyler, youngish as heck.
And he's put in so much great work just on his handle. He looks smooth. He looks good. You got to increase Tyler, who's just 20 years old. Thank you, Dylan. 20 years old. I think this is the time to give him some, just throw him in the fire a little bit more. Not a lot, you know, spoon feeding, but still throw him out there in some meaningful minute type situations. And see what he does. I mean, because he's got my old acting coach, Rick Edelstein, who worked with Barbara Streisand for years and years and years. But Rick would talk about the molecular structure when you're in character and how you change. Denzel and De Niro and Christopher Walken, how there's a molecular structure that changes. Tyler Smith right now, Chris, his molecular, he looks like a man. He don't look like a, you know what I mean? He didn't look like a 20-year-old kind of deer in headlights kind of look. He looks like, I belong out here. I know what I'm doing. Give me the rock. Tween, behind tween, step back, lefty jumper, yeah. But I was watching him, but then my boy that I really love, and Jamari Bouye, you know, that hit the game winner, that beat Denver. After they'd gotten down by two, he went by the Coach Love, who's coaching the summer league, and said, Coach, should I shoot a two or shoot a three? They're down two. And the Coach Love said,
summer league, bro.
Shoot a three. Let's win it. 5 seconds left. But Jamari Bouye, man, that last game against the Pistons fan appreciation door, that he had a 20-plus point game. Nobody remembers that because Connaughton had 43, and Pete Nance had a great game, 20, and all these guys were scoring
Kuz
crazy numbers.
Kuz had 20 in the first quarter or something,
Kuz had 20 to start. He just came out the gate just firing. And so, but Jamari Bouye, man, it may not be here with the Bucks because of a numbers issue.
Yeah.
But he's been around with some San Antonio and Golden, some different Miami, different organizations. He played for Todd Golden at USF. Todd Golden coached Florida to a national championship. He played.
I remember Bouye over there. I remember USF. I remember that.
Yeah, yeah. He's West Coast Conference 2 years in a row.
I forgot he played over there.
He's got game, man. I'm telling you, he's got the same thing, Chris, that I saw in Ryan Rollins in training camp last year. Just something about him the it factor that makes it seem like he belongs on this level. And everybody. Sometimes it's so easy for young guys, especially in his circumstances, to be struggling and searching for it. He's got it. He's comfortable. He's confident with it, man. And so I expect big things from him. So, it's going to be interesting to see. This is what makes the Summer League really, really important for guys like Andre Jackson Jr., Chris Livingston, like some of these
on a lot of levels. On a lot of levels. Dudes are deciding their future. In a major way. Carback Ryan, his future is big. Could Ryan be like PC was? Is he as athletic as PC, younger PC?
He's not as athletic.
Live defensively? I mean, does he get after it at all on the defensive end?
He's tough. He's tough. He's hard-nosed defensively.
But could it translate to the NBA level?
Yes. Without a question, yes. Okay. But he's a much better – he has a much better offensive mindset in terms of buckets. He's got that Duncan Robinson, Sam Merrill, type mindset when it comes to getting buckets out there.
You go bust your ass.
Well, you can't leave him, and he knows how to find the openings, knows how to move without the basketball, knows how to play off of the ball handler. So with him and Giannis, Giannis used to love to have these guards, Brent Forbes and guards like that, Dellavedova, that could set screens and give that ghost screen, that slip, and slip into space, and then Giannis would hit him for an open jumper. A guy like Carmack and Ryan could make a freaking fortune, like AJ Green. He does that with AJ Green a little bit. He can make a living playing with Giannis and just running that action over and over again. So that'll be fun to watch.
But this is what you love to see from the Bucks: the emergence of developing young talent that are going to come on the cheap. Remember, we talked about this before with the second apron and all this other stuff. Finding the gems in the gym are going to be every single front office's goal every single year. And I'm hoping that this guy fits checks out.
Well, and that will be our theme for the upcoming episodes of Here District while the Summer League is in play in Vegas. The gems in the gym.
Yes, sir.
Finding the gems in the gym. I love that. We're going to be looking for it, man. All right, man. Sounds great. We have got a great guest coming up, a guy that I've known since I was a freshman at UCLA. He was my trainer then. A rookie in Milwaukee in the first couple of years. He was my trainer then, Tony Spino, and he's got some really, really astute observations about all these Achilles injuries. And plus, he's going to talk about his association with the legend John Wooden. So stay tuned for the B Block. We got some great stuff coming up here at District. Coming right back with Tony Spino. Chris and I are the only father and son tandem in the history of NCAA basketball to win a national championship at the same school. And speaking of that school, UCLA, have a guy that is a UCLA icon. I can say an icon, right, Chris? I mean,
just one
of the all-time great icons of UCLA and a friend of mine. And Tony Spino. Tony, welcome, first of all, to Here District. Glad to have you.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm happy to be here. Thank you for asking me on.
We had to bring you in to get your expertise on a variety of different subjects. But trainer Tony was at UCLA starting in 1971 or so, I believe, and then stayed at UCLA for 4 years until 75, and then became the trainer for the Milwaukee Bucks back in 1975. And that was under Larry Costello, and that's when, Junior Bridgman and Dave Myers were rookies and a lot of young talented players. So Tony was kind of here at the beginning with the Milwaukee Bucks. We got a lot to talk about. But Chris, I don't know if you knew this, but our nickname for Tony with the Bucks was The Rock.
The Rock?
The Rock. And any guy from that era, you talk about Spino, how's The Rock doing? Tony, where did that come from? Do you remember how that nickname came about?
I really don't. I think it came from you, but I think we were playing Denver, the Denver Nuggets in the playoffs, and we were in game seven, and we were about to get off the bus. And I said, today we need to give them the knockout punch.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think someone said, oh, the Rock is going to knock them out. Well, it came all the way down to the last play, and we game seven. We would have went on to play in the finals of the West.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we were in the West back then, not in the East, and in the Western Conference. And, you know, we missed the shot. And lost the game.
Yeah. And that was a Nuggets team. Larry Brown was the coach. Larry was sporting Chris, like the psychedelic shirts with the fly collars and the overalls
and the denim
overalls and all. David Thompson and Bobby Jones.
Kind of had an afro. He kind of had his own little version of an afro.
He had it going. Yeah. And I think the Rockets, Tony's from New Jersey. I think part of that, and that was 1977-ish, 78. I think the Rocky Balboa. The Sylvester Stallone piece was out right around then, the first Rocky. I'd have to look that up, but I think that was a part of it because Tony had that tough, you know, that tough kind of New Jersey Philly thing going on, and Junior Bridgman used to love calling him that, the Italian Stallion, the Rock. Yeah, it was all about that, man. But Tony, and I mentioned Junior Bridgman, man, and we lost him a few months back. Just some memories about Junior. Talk about Junior and just your reflections on Junior Bridgman, one of the owners of the Milwaukee Bucks.
We would always hold a lot of conversations and stuff. And he always told me, he said, you know, I want to be a Supreme Court judge someday.
Did he?
And he says, I'm going to take law classes in the summer because the season ended in May. So he went up to the University of Wisconsin in Madison every summer and took two or three courses. You know, that was going to be his goal, you know, because he always knew that playing wasn't forever and he was going to have to, he wanted to do something. And, you know, I knew he grew up really poor and he grew up in, you know, in a real tough neighborhood. He told me some things that he witnessed, you know, things that he would have liked to see different. And he told me the story about how he, you know, wanted to join the Boy Scouts. One of his friends was a Boy Scout. He came home with a uniform on. Junior brought him over to see his parents, and he asked his parents if he could join to get one of those uniforms. And his parents said, well, how much would it cost? And they said, $1.25. And the parents said, sorry, Junior, we don't have the money for it.
Mm. Wow. See, people today, it's just hard to even relate to that kind of a story. But Junior was working with his dad, like at the dad would get him up at 4 a.m. to go work and clean buildings before school. You know, this is before school.
His dad worked in the same steel mill with Joe Jackson, the father of the Jacksons, because the Jackson family lived on the same block with Junior.
Okay.
And his dad and Junior's dad used to work in a steel mill together.
Wow.
In Gary, Indiana. Yeah.
Wow. See, that's you're telling me stuff. I thought I knew pretty much everything there was to know about Junior's life, but that's a fascinating story. Tony, it was just an article was just released a couple of days ago where Eden Bridgman, Junior's daughter, said that the family was going to stay active with their 10% ownership stake with the Milwaukee Bucks, that, you know, she felt like, you know, Jimmy Haslam and the people in place would be more than fine handling the day-to-day stuff. But they wanted to maintain that connection because that was such a major deal, man. How did you feel when you heard that Junior was finally going to get a piece of an NBA team after years of trying?
Well, I mean, I talked to him about it when he got very successful with Wendy's. And I said, Junior, why haven't you bought into, an NBA team? And he said, the return was not as great as it was when Jim Fitzgerald did the Bucks, and then he bought the Golden State Warriors, and then he sold, you know, both of those. His returns were really great. Well, I mean, you know, Junior, I mean, he did his homework on it, and he knew he would have always liked to. And I always say, why don't you buy a team? And he says, but the return won't be as great. So it was interesting because then he ventured off in giving his children and letting them run the, you know, Bridgman Foods Incorporated. And he invested in Coca-Cola, which Julius Erving was, when he played, was very invested in Coca-Cola. And I don't know if you know, but like his wife got to fly to all the games, all the road games in a private plane provided by Coca-Cola, Julius.
Yeah, turquoise, wife. Okay, wow.
And so Junior jumped into that, and he became like on the biggest in the Eastern Seaboard and in Eastern Canada. He had the biggest distributing company of Coca-Cola. So he was making a real good living off of that.
Cash cow.
And his dream was always to be also, once he got into the business, he wanted to become a billionaire. And he finally became a billionaire, and then he lost his life, which is so hard. I mean, it hit me like a ton of bricks. I mean, this guy was so generous in giving to the community. I mean, I've stayed at his house with his family when his kids were little. We would go to church together. He was very, very religious. He always wanted to help others in the community, because he never forgot his roots. He never forgot what he went through as a child. And he always wanted it to be better, not only for him, but for everyone.
Yeah.
And we would always talk, even when I was gone. You know, he would come in the summer out here to work out. He'd come up to the training room, and I'd work on his knee, or I'd work on, one of his, injuries. And, he would ask me for advice. So we always stayed in touch, through the years. And I'm telling you, that this hit me really hard. I mean, I've had a real hard time with it.
Yeah, we all have. And I told you my story about, how my housekeeper, Irene, I had a poster, a big, gigantic poster, Chris, behind my bed, still in cellophane. A junior had an endorsement for Cousin Subs in Milwaukee. So he's at the front of the poster holding a sub sandwich, super sub, and then the entire team is paired up behind him. I'm with Paul Pressey and the coaching staff, and everybody is in this picture, Bob Lanier and Randy Brewer and Sidney Moncrief and everybody. And I look at it every morning because she put it up without my permission. I was kind of mad at first, but now it's like a bigger purpose was involved in her putting that thing up. And it's still in cellophane. Never took it out of cellophane. It's hanging on the wall in cellophane. That's how tacky I am. I got a poster hanging up in cellophane, but it's just a constant reminder of that team, Tony, the good times that we had. What do you remember? I want to know what do you remember about me coming in as a 21-year-old rookie? I mean, could you tell I had a little bit of a knucklehead aspect to me, that I was going to kind of venture off the road a little bit at times? But what was your impressions of me? You knew me since I was a freshman.
I remember a lot of players when, Junior, especially, and Dave Myers, and those guys. And
Quinn Buckner, Kent Benson,
Who I always stay, he's the president of the Board of Regents at the University of Indiana now.
Kent Benson is, okay. Quinn Buckner. Well, I remember that. I mean, you're in that famous video of Kent Benson, our very first game in 1977, opening night against the Lakers. When Ken had made some comments in the papers to Bob Wolf of the Milwaukee Sentinel, the morning paper, and said that he was going to rough Kareem up, going to give him an elbow, see how he took it. So Kent gives Kareem an elbow, and then Kareem double clutches, Chris, you've seen this video, and then plants this right foot and then socks Kent in the side of the jaw, and Kent goes down. I didn't see it. I was guarding Jamal Wilkes out top. I heard it. You just heard a thud. A turn, and Kent stumbling, and Kareem is dancing over him, Chris, like Muhammad Ali. Get up! Get up, MF-er! Get up! And I'm like, and I knew Kareem, so I'm like, Kareem, he's not getting up, man. Back off, man. Back off. He's not getting up,
Right.
And then Tony was the guy. There's a famous photo of Tony. Kareem is in the background dancing. Kent has got his arm around Tony. Tony's kind of helping him off the floor. But, man, that was a crazy night, right? That was my maiden voyage, Tony. That was my first game as a rookie with the Bucks.
Nelly really encouraged him to rough him up. And I think what happened, and I mean, it was a horrible situation because Kent really struggled.
Yeah, he did. He did.
Kind of really hurt his career.
Yeah, and he was a solid player. He was always felt a little, a little. Yeah. I was in my feelings a little because I thought I should have been the number one pick, and they traded Swin Nader to get the third pick from Buffalo, drafted Kent number one, drafted me number three, and so my first week of practice, I was trying to dunk on him every time just to prove a point. But you mentioned Nelly. Why didn't Don Nelson ever get a team into the NBA Finals? What do you think of Don Nelson as a guy? I know you and Nelly, had your moments, to say
yes,
the least.
Did.
You
yes.
And what was your impression of Nelly as a coach? And why do you think he was never able to get this team?
One thing that I remember, he was one of the first guys to bring in video, and record and go over the plays. He spent more money on a video guy and hired a video guy and got all this equipment than anybody was making, players or anybody.
Wow.
He spent Muko bucks on this. So he was way ahead of the game there. I think, he was very slick. He learned a lot from Red Auerbach.
Okay.
I remember when they fired Larry Costello, we were in Seattle, and he came to my room and said, "What do you think they fired Larry? What do you think I should do?" And I said, and this is what I told him. I said, "This place is a mess." And I said, "The only way it's going to get straightened out is we need a head coach who's the general manager, only one opinion, and that guy's got to run the show, just like Red Auerbach." I said, "If you want to be successful, you got to be like Red." I said, and he took that and ran with it. And obviously, down the road, I think he forgot it and let me go. But I wasn't on the contract. I mean, I could have been let go anytime. But my salary, I was a trainer. I was the equipment manager. I was a strength and conditioning guy.
The traveling secretary.
Traveling secretary. And Chris, I washed the uniforms on the road.
Yeah. So how did you balance all that, though? Like, you got to make travel and tape ankles. How are you balancing that, Tony? You have a schedule. You had a method. Because I know you're meticulous and you're calculating how you do stuff. Talk to me.
Well, what I did is I took care of the players first. That was number one. When they left for the day, I stayed all day. I mean, they practiced for 2.5 hours. They took a shower. They got their treatment. They went home. I stayed there and took care of that. So treatment was number one, okay? Like, if it was a game day, I'd stay there all day. I work with the ball boys. We'd set up the visiting locker room, the umpire's room, the officials room, so we would get everything ready. So by the time they came back to get ready for the game, I was already there. And I organized that. When we were on the road, I did the same thing. I took care of I had to book the flights.
Yeah.
And then I had to get the buses. Okay. And then I had to get the rooms and make sure everybody had their room. And we were fortunate. Everybody had their own room with the Bucks. We didn't have roommates.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so but a lot of teams had roommates. A lot of teams would go to the airport and didn't even know if they could get on a plane back then because they didn't know if their bills would be paid or their tickets would be paid.
It's a different day. Different day. Man, it's a different day.
And so I would take care of that. And then I would arrange for the bus to go to shoot around, or practice.
Yeah.
And then I would arrange for the bus to go to the game. And then after the game, I would do treatments there or ice people down and I would check with everybody. And then I'd go to the laundromat and I would wash the uniforms and then I would dry them and then I'd fold them up. I had a big army duffel bag, a green duffel bag, and I'd fold up all the uniforms and put them in there.
Man.
I used to carry 12 bags on the road, 12.
Wow.
Doing the Lord's work.
Because I had to bring 12 basketballs. That was two bags right there.
Tony, let me ask you this. Having seen that entire generation of ball players who didn't have the technological advancement that a lot of the players have today, a lot of, the conversation is centered around that era, athletically inferior, skills inferior. I'd like
plumbers playing against plumbers back in those days.
Plumbers, right, Tony? So I want to know from you just your opinion on, as a trainer, right, like, do you feel like yesterday's athlete would be able to compete in today's NBA?
Oh, there's absolutely no question because today they have the conditioning, they have the weights, they're bigger, they're stronger. Like Coach Wooden always told me, you can't compare errors, but to look at the players back then, I mean, you got to understand one thing, that we only had 11 guys on the roster. There was no D League, G League. Only two Americans could play in Europe on a team, if that's what they choose to do. I mean, if you got cut in training camp, you went on with your life because there was no basketball left for you. And those guys, they had to play through everything. They had to play hurt. They knew they had to come every day with it to give them their best. And I mean, you mean to tell me that Julius Erving couldn't play, Marcus Johnson couldn't play today?
Dominic Wilkins, Larry Bird, right. Yeah.
Let me tell you, I was out, Larry Bird. Yeah. You know, I was out several years before the pandemic out at the Pro Summer League with Wayne Embry, and we were sitting there and we were discussing things. And he was telling me they had a guy in Toronto, the 15th player on the team, didn't play at all, was a guy who traveled. He was 1 year contract for $45 million. Mm. $45 million. And I went, wait a second, man. If these guys, when I was in the league, could play now, oh my gosh. What would they be making?
Yeah, that's
it. What would they be making? I mean, it's, I don't know if you're aware of this, but Cooper Flagg, who played at Duke last year.
Yeah.
$25 million he got for 1 year.
Wow.
$25 million
he got. For the NIL for Duke?
For Duke.
Yeah.
Play right. At Duke, 20, really?
That's $25 million, and they offered him $45 million to stay another year. That's why he was thinking about coming back.
Yeah, the word is he got real big money. Duke has it. They got the Tech Bros, the VC kind of fund. Yeah. They got like
There's a great article in the Wall Street Journal.
I saw that.
Duke puts their money through the stock market.
Yeah. Wow. That is absolutely nuts.
I asked Coach Wooden, I said, Coach, I said, how does Coach K, and I love Coach K, don't get me wrong, I love him. We have a great relationship, he and I. I said, how does Coach K get these players? And he said, Tony, everybody has their ways.
Mm, wow. Wow.
That was his answer.
Yep. Well, listen, man, let's move forward here and talk about, speaking of eras, I mean, I don't remember, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm trying to remember one teammate of mine in Milwaukee that had an Achilles. I think Tiny Archibald may have had something during the course of his career, but and we've had seven this year.
Yeah,
you get all these excuses, Tony, in terms of not excuses, but rationalizations about wearing low top shoes, yeah, wearing three quarter shoes. Everybody should wear high tops. It's the shoes, right. But you've got some observations on maybe what you think is the culprit behind all these Achilles injuries.
Yeah, well, my question is, the style of shoes today is people are more interested in style than. The safety of it.
Yeah.
Are they making shoes just for looks, or are they really making them for support? The player at Duke who's in the NBA now, didn't he blow out his shoes right on national TV?
Zion Williamson. Yes.
Yes. I mean, he blew them right out. Right. I remember back when everybody used the gum rubber sole. And nobody had these injuries. Nobody. And they had Converse, and they were just
paper thin,
but they had a great sole, yeah, and they gripped the floor. I think it's the conditioning to jump higher, I think it all goes back. We didn't see all these injuries when there wasn't weightlifting. As soon as they put all this weightlifting in and everybody wants to be bigger and stronger, I mean, that's great. But your muscles will get bigger and stronger, but your ligaments and your tendons will hold the stress from that. They do not get bigger and stronger. They do not expand. They break. Yeah, they rip.
And they're taking the brunt of all that power you're trying to generate. It's on the muscles and tendons.
Sure, but Tony, my question is, how much do the shoes matter?
How much do the shoes matter? I don't think it's the shoes. I don't.
Does the type of shoe matter more? Like, the shoes back in the day versus the shoes today. Now, they, you know, I look at that. I see that you got MJ, you guys were playing in kind of hard sole, didn't have the same cushioning, didn't have all the technology stuff, but you had less injuries. So I'm just trying to get my wrap my head around what your kind of the science behind it, Tony.
Yeah, I mean, there, you know, there is a science behind it. And, you know, I know that, you know, there's been a lot of research done, but I mean, I've never seen so many Achilles tendon. I remember Tiny Nate Archibald played for the Boston Celtics. He tore his Achilles tendon, say on the left side. He came back a year later, put all of his weight on his right side, blew out his right Achilles tendon. His career was over. But this is a career-ending injury in a lot of cases. The only person that I've looked up, like, and I've been studying this a little bit, Kevin Durant stayed out 18 months. Yeah. He said, I'm not coming back until I'm 100%. And if I'm not 100%, I'm not coming back. Because all these other guys, I think they're trying to rush coming back from these surgeries. And I understand when you put a guy – and you monitor all season long to reduce his minutes. And then all of a sudden you put him in the playoffs and they're trying to win an NBA title. They ain't going to get no reduced minutes. They're going to be out there the whole time, especially a superstar player. You know, I mean, Boston lost the NBA title because of an Achilles tendon.
Jason Tatum. Yeah. Yeah. Well, so you mentioned Kevin Durant. Yeah. So this is a quick story, Chris. Kevin Durant hurt his soleus or something, the lower calf, when he was with the Golden State Warriors. They played him in the playoffs that year. He wind up hurting the Achilles. It was a connection there in some kind of way. Now, he sat out that time, Tony, went to Brooklyn. Game 7 against the Milwaukee Bucks, Chris. You remember this game, June 19th, your daughter Kalila's graduation from high school at SoFi Arena. Then we rushed home to watch the final quarter of that Game 7 Bucks against the Brooklyn Nets, Eastern Conference semis, maybe, I think, at that point. And my point is this, Tony, that Steve Nash, the coach of Brooklyn, Kevin Durant had been out 18 months. Steve Nash played Kevin Durant the whole game. That was an overtime game. He played him the whole game, 53 minutes. But there was this famous shot that KD hit where his toe was on the line, and everybody likes to say, well, if he would have had a shoe size one size smaller, 16 instead of a 17, they would have beat the Bucks. It wasn't that. Fatigue makes cowards of us all. He played the whole game and just kind of – and I kept saying as a family, we're watching the game in my den at home, and I'm saying, you know, he's not – Steve Nash is not going to give this guy one break after he's been out, the length of time he's been out. It's going to come back to hurt them some kind of way. So he missed – so he made that shot, but his foot was on the line, had a big shot to win it in overtime, a three-pointer, shot an air ball. And so to me – just having an understanding, if you're Steve, I always held Steve Nash responsible for that, as opposed to Kevin Durant's shoe size. He's been wearing a 17 shoe, you know, yeah, since he's been an adult. It's not like his foot grew an inch over right. The summer or something.
They didn't give him an extra size shoe.
Yeah. But I'm saying the fatigue. I mean, you can't play a guy that long who plays that hard, that effectively, and not expect some kind of diminishing returns at some point.
Right, and I'm going to say this. Excuse me, Chris. Kevin came into the Wooden Center to work out.
Yeah.
All by himself. And we dropped the curtain down, and he played on the court, and I went out to give him some water, you know, some Gatorade, and I watched him for a while. And he missed every single shot he was taking from all different angles on the court. And he looked at me and he says, "Why do you think I'm missing all my shots?" I said, "Kevin, when have you taken a day off?" And he says, "I haven't." I said, "Take the rest of the day off. Take tomorrow off. Come back the next day, and I bet you won't miss a shot." He took day and a half off, came back, didn't miss a shot.
Yeah, yeah. So overuse. And that's the thing
that I told him. You need to recoup your body. I said, you need a rest.
So, yeah. Kevin, but like Tony, like, when you're an athletic trainer, the team medical staff, and you're faced with a conundrum like the Pacers and the Bucks, you had Tyrese Haliburton kind of limping around, pushing through an injury in games, you know, 2 and 3, I believe. And then Dame Lillard kind of, you know, not looking like himself, but kind of laboring a little bit, not laboring, but favoring slightly. As a medical trainer, when you're seeing that and you're in the throes of the playoffs, how hard is that call? Who's that call on to shut a guy down? Because had you shut down a Halliburton, this wouldn't have happened. But then with the, you know, the Pacers obviously wouldn't. Well, who knows what type of chance they would have had. But again, I'm just trying to get to the how you the thought process, Tony, in shutting down.
When the you see thought process play. Is you feel, you in the team position feel, hey, he shouldn't play this game. And then the coach says, hey, what, are you crazy? And then the player says, I'm playing. I'm playing. Game seven. Yeah. This is the championship. Do you know how hard it is to win an NBA championship? It took Milwaukee Bucks 50 years.
I know. Yes.
Yeah. It's very hard. Even to win a college championship, yeah. It's very hard. People, I mean, very few teams repeat. Unless all the guys come back and they're healthy, it's very hard to repeat. And yeah, you may have said, I don't think you should play. The doctor could say, I don't think you should play. Now you got the coach looking at you like, what, are you crazy? My job is on the line. I got to win the NBA title.
Yeah.
But you know what? By playing him, it not only hurt him, but it hurt the team. So they lost in both ends.
Yeah. But Tony, quick follow-up to that. You were responsible for rehabilitating Ed O'Bannon, who had one of the most serious knee injuries that we've seen on the basketball floor. Do the same type of pressures to speed Ed's recovery, to get Ed back on the floor? Did the same type of pressure exist at UCLA as it does in the NBA?
Absolutely. That was one of the worst and longest 18 months I ever had in my life because I had to monitor Ed. Coaches were trying to force him to come back. They even forced him to go to a different doctor who told him that he'd have him back in 4 months.
Wow.
And that guy, and I'll go online and say, that guy ruined his life. He ruined his career because when he got in here, he didn't know what to do to how to repair it. And he'll walk around today and say, I repaired Ed O'Bannon's knee because no one at UCLA knew what to do.
And so you're saying he made it worse, this doctor actually?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah, is that why it took so long?
You got to understand, Ed had five things wrong with that. He didn't have just an ACL. He had a fracture. Mm. He tore his meniscus. He tore both ligaments, medial and collateral ligaments. I mean, that knee was shattered. I mean, when he went to the combines, I told his parents, if you want him to be the number one pick in the NBA, don't send him to the combines.
Yeah.
Because what do the combines do? They give you a physical. They give him an MRI. I had 15 phone calls. Who did this knee? Who did that knee? I said, we didn't do it. He went outside. And that's all I said.
Wow. So Feinerman didn't do the knee?
No. He was in Hawaii on vacation when it happened, and Dr. Grauer, who was his assistant, was going to do it. Dr. Grauer was waiting in the operating room that morning, and Ed never showed up. Mm-hmm. He went out to the valley to have this guy who worked on skiers and said, I can get back in 4 months.
Yeah. Wow.
18 months later, Ed came back. 18 months later, he finally got off the bench. I had a worry every single day, I don't know if you remember this, Chris, but we didn't practice Ed all week. I treated him and got the swelling down so he could play. And we were fortunate to have a lot of games that year on Friday, Sunday. So Ed always had those days off.
Yeah.
And it was just treatment. Just treatment.
Wow.
Nothing
wow.
else. Yeah. No. And I used to try to get, and he would wear that sleeve over his knee. Because he got so upset about people staring at his knee. Why is this always swollen? Why won't it go down?
Yeah.
And what do you tell him? The guy screwed up?
Yeah.
Well, what am I doing? I'm in the middle of this for 5 years.
Right. Well, one thing, Tony, I got to give the Bucks credit for, because Giannis had a situation in April of 2024 against the Boston Celtics. And I always say that he had this little bit of a tete-a-tete with Drew Holiday in the key, and Drew kind of drove him down to the ground, and Giannis stayed there for a moment. It looked like his left foot got caught up under him. He fell awkwardly. But later on in that game, he continued to play, continued to dunk and run and jump. But later in that game, no contact. He's just walking back down the court, and he drops to the floor, and it's a soleus. And we all thought it was an Achilles, but it was actually the soleus muscle. But to the Bucks' credit, they didn't rush him back. He missed the whole playoffs. We lost in the first round or whatever it was to Miami, I believe, that year. But, I mean, to your point, I mean, you've got to have that medical staff that's looking at the long game, looking at the big picture.
You look at the long term for him, you know. I mean, the soleus is connected to the calf, which is connected to the Achilles tendon.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
If what would have happened is if he would have pulled that muscle or tore that muscle, he could have easily tore his Achilles.
Wow.
and ruptured his Achilles.
Yeah, and I think that's what happened to Kevin Durant. Kevin Durant, it was like a soleus type injury, and then that turned into an Achilles.
And that's the thing I was going to mention, that a lot of these Achilles are overlooked because they're examining the calf and the soleus, but they're not looking at the Achilles.
Yeah.
The Achilles is attached to the heel bone right in the back. And it goes all the way up. And when it ruptures, it curls all the way up into the calf. And they have to pull that down and sew it back down.
Yeah.
You know, and what happens is you get a little tear in there. And they say, well, you know, you got a little tear in the calf, you know, or the soleus, it's going to be all right. Well, that leads to a rupture.
Yeah.
And bang, you know, and I think they're looking up too high and not looking down enough. And they may be, and I you know, I'm not in the league. I'm not there anymore. I don't really, you know, I can't really say that people are wrong, but something's going on, and there's no way you can have that many. I mean, you know, that many.
So pace of play doesn't factor into this. How the, you know, they're trying to say the pace has something to do, Spino. Do you think it has anything to do with it?
The pace?
Pace
of play, how fast they play up
how
and down.
Fast, guys, up and how down fast, guys. How fast the NBA game is now with threes.
No, that's just conditioning. And what I look at, and what I've mentioned, you know, before is, you know, Gatorade is great, okay? But are they getting enough water? Are they – cramp can lead to this. A cramp, you can cramp, which will cause a pull, which will cause a rupture. I mean, in any part of the body, are they drinking enough water? I mean, Gatorade does not reduce cramps. Mm. If you get cramps and you go in for an IV, you look at what's in that bag. It's fluid and sodium, which they don't do sodium anymore. That's salt.
We take salt pills back. We take Ducky Drake would hand out salt pills at practice back in the day. Yeah, prevent cramping.
Well,
yes.
You know what we did in football? We had a tablespoon for every gallon. We had one tablespoon for every gallon. And we would fill up these 10-gallon jugs. We put tons of ice in there, stir it up. And we would go to the Rose Bowl or the Coliseum back then. And it'd be September, and it'd be 110 degrees on the field. And we didn't have one single cramp.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's something. Yep.
You know, there was no cramping. I mean, and cramps can lead to a more serious injury. They're researching all this out and everything, but seven or eight Achilles in one season?
Well, they're supposed to have a report to be presented at the Board of Governors meeting in the Summer League because Adam Silver, he's trying to address this issue. What do you – fewer games, try and change the training regimen? Matt Barnes had a great observation responding to – this podcast, It Is What It Is, with Mace and Cameron, they were talking about it's the low cuts, it's the three-quarter cuts. And his observation, Chris Tony, was that these young men today play so much AAU basketball during the offseason where you're playing six, seven games a week during the course of Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, two and three games a day, every single weekend. I mean, it's a money grab. You're playing every weekend. And the fact that there's no versatility. Back in the day, you played baseball in the summer or football in the fall, and you didn't put as much stress on that basketball, you know, muscle Achilles wise. And what are your thoughts on that? Just in terms of just too much wear and tear. By the time they get to the NBA, they played so many games that it's just
well, and you know, even when you're growing up, you play on really tough surfaces.
Yeah,
you play on cement, right? I mean, you go on the playground, you're not going to have a wood floor. You're going to have cement.
Yeah.
And over time, as you get older, you know that your body starts breaking down and you're where, you know, these injuries can occur because you have so much wear and tear in your body before it starts breaking down. And if you're doing this at a very young age,
yeah,
at an age of, you know, from 25 to 35, that's when you're going to start feeling it. Yeah. It's like, if you don't have any issues when you're 35 and you start having issues when you're 75 or 70, then you're going to say, where'd that come from? Well, it came from all the hard work you did over the years. Yeah. Now, should they have less practice time? You know, I mean, I know they have much better travel facilities now, and they get to travel on a, you know, on a private plane, and they can come home after a game, or they can get to the next city after a game and things like that. But I mean, are they practicing 1 hour, two hours,
yeah,
3 hours? You know, 3 hours. I calculated 1 year, we had a coach, Walt Hazard, and I calculated for a whole season, our third hour of practice, and every one of our injuries were in the third hour.
Wow. Wow.
Every one of my injuries were in the third hour. Yeah. Not the first, not the second, but because mentally you get tired, you're not hearing the coaches anymore, and you're just reacting, and you're going to get hurt.
Yeah.
Because you lose a step and you're just not quite as sharp as you were the first and second hour.
Well, speaking of succinct and deliberate and organized practices, the guy I played for at UCLA the first 2 years, John Wooden, 2 hours, man. We went from, you know, 3:30 to 5:30, whatever it was, 3 to 5. That was it. Every drill, structured 5-minute drills. People may not realize this, Tony, but you were Coach Wooden's personal caretaker. What, the last 20 years of his life, I believe. Just can you give us a few John Wooden stories, because you got a chance to be around him and to share some things with him that we can only dream about, man. Can you give us a few stories about the kind of people he was conversing with and the friendships that he had in terms of people, some notable folks out there?
Yeah, well, I used to kid him a lot. And, you know, I mean, I spent 35 years, 3 days a week. No one at UCLA knew it. I went and met with him because he had a shoulder injury, and I had to take him to the doctor, and the physician said, gave him an injection. He had a little inflammation, and the doctor said, Tony, always take care of the coach, help him out, always take care of him. So for 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I would go to his place at 6 in the morning, and from 6 to 9, I would be with him. We would do therapy. Sometime I'd bring him up to UCLA for traction on his back or things like that. And I'd bring him back. I'd bring him to breakfast. I'd bring him to his doctor's appointment. And by 9 o'clock, I was gone and I went back to work. I did that for 35 years. And I did it on a handshake that I'm doing this for free. I'm doing this for you. You do a lot for others and somebody needs to do something for you. And I said, once someone finds out about this, and they say, I'm doing it for money or any other reason, I go, I'm going to stop. And we shook handshake on it. And that's how it started. When we were alone in the car, like if we went to dinner, met his daughter, I would drive home. He always loved it because he could talk to me and he could tell me anything that was on his mind. You know, he felt very comfortable and he always enjoyed that time, that quiet time. Although we would play the radio and if a song came on, we both would sing and neither one of us could sing. So that was
funny. Yeah.
But I got a story about, you know, people always ask me, you know, what kind of guy was John Wooden? You knew him pretty well and this and that. Well, one morning, and I was living with him at that time, and the phone rang. And he had his chair in the corner, and the phone was on a little table with his calendar, his daily calendar. And the phone rings, and he says, Tony, answer the phone. I said, okay, coach. So I answered the phone. I said, hello, it's John Wooden's home. And they said, this is the White House calling. And I said, oh, okay. And they said, you know, this is is John Wooden there? And I said, yeah. I said, can I help you? And he says, yeah, this is President Bill Clinton.
Uh-oh.
And I said, oh really? Oh, okay. So I said, please hold on. So I put my hand over the receiver. And I said, Coach, I said, President Clinton is on the phone and wants to speak to you. Yeah, sure he is. Sure. Who's on the phone? And I said, Coach, President Clinton's on the phone. I said, yeah, he wants to talk to you. So he said, all right, give me the phone. So he goes, hello? And he goes, you know, Bill says, you know, this is President Clinton. The coach, he looked up at me, goes, you weren't kidding. I go, no, it's President, you know? And so he started talking to him, and he was coming out here, and he wanted to have lunch with Coach. And Coach says, okay, give me my calendar. Let me look at my calendar. So I'm leaning over the chair, and he's looking at his calendar. And on a Wednesday, there was this all-girls school from Iowa, a college team, small. The coach was out here. He had made appointment to bring the girls over to meet Coach on that Wednesday morning. But Thursday was wide open, and they were going to be in town for a week. Mm. And I said, Coach, we'll change it. And he looked at me, and he says, I don't change my commitments.
Wow.
And we never had the lunch with wow. President Clinton. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, things like that. I mean, you know, I said, okay, you know, yeah. I just said, sorry, you know, but I had to hang up. So. Yeah.
And Coach, it's funny. One of my great memories, hanging out at the condo on Margate in Encino, Tony, was he had this recording of Bobby Knight. So someone had recorded him, you know, serendipitously without him knowing, and every other word was F this and F M. I mean, and Coach would just get so tickled, like he played it for you, like listen to Bobby Knight's halftime talk to his team, and he would get so tickled, man, just listening to Bobby just go on a tirade and cuss players out, man, and there was no love lost, I don't think, between those two.
No, he always, you know, Bobby Knight did a lot of things for people on the street for, you know, he really had a soft side that he never wanted anybody to see.
Sure. Yeah.
He did some kind things for people along the way, but Coach Wooden always said, my son couldn't play for you.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. They're two different styles, man. Yeah, well, look, man. We're going to let you go, man. We appreciate you coming by, man, and shedding and dropping the knowledge on the Achilles, on the injuries, man. Nobody better to do it than you. You've been around this game a long, long time, and we just appreciate you for taking care of Coach. I do, in particular, just knowing the affinity that I have for him, and I just appreciate you, man. You were really instrumental in my career, and just people don't understand, Tony, that an athletic trainer, and Chris can relate to this. I mean, you're more than just a trainer. You know, you're a psychologist. You know, you're the guy that helps us when we're feeling at our lowest because we can't play. We don't know if we're going to come back 100%. We don't know when we're going to come back. And you are always so good, man, at just being diligent with the rehab, but also the mental aspect, man, keeping me focused and feeling good and that I was going to be, you know, better than before when I came back, as long as I followed, you know, whatever regimen you laid out for me, man. And people just don't have a clue that are not in the game how important that is. Right, Chris?
Yeah, no. And the second on second that, Tony was when I had the knee, I think, before UCLA, and then when I had the stress factor. So two of the most catastrophic injuries I had personally suffered going into my freshman year, literally the summer of my freshman year and then that December. And Tony got me back both times. But, Dad, you talked about the mental aspect. And I remember, Tony, our sessions up at the pool at Sunset Rec when you had me with the weight vest. And, you know, I'm trying to lose weight and you're talking to me about the weight loss and getting into shape. That stuff really resonated and it meant the world to me. And I've always appreciated you for that. And I like to end it by saying this. Sure, there's a lot of athletic trainers out there. And I've had my experience with many of them. There's no Tony Spino. So, MJ, to your point, Tony is a different breed. Like, that's why we view him through the lens in which we view him. He's not your normal athletic trainer. He's like a high level. He's your friend. He's your person that cares about you deeply, but also plugged into the mental aspect. Tony, I just want to say I appreciate everything you've done. and continue to do for our, us and our family, man. You're always the man, and we love you.
And listen, if there's some UCLA people out there in sports administration, you need to get this guy in the Hall of Fame. You know, we've been trying to get him in for years and years, and Tony's not, you know, he's not the kind of guy that's gonna beat his own drum, but he deserves to be, just for the fact he took care of Coach Wooden. He's been around the program since the early 70s. He's you know, been the trainer for myself, for my son, for hundreds of athletes. And
I had Josiah. Don't forget Josiah.
Had all the Johnsons. Had Josiah also, man. That's crazy, man. So you've been really good to my family, man. Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
You guys have been good to me. And you know, I really appreciate all the old Bruins, all the Bruins that, you know, they always said that, and I not said this, but they've always said to me, you kept Coach around a lot longer so we could enjoy him. Mm. And I think that means a lot to me, you know. You know, because people, I used to say, you're like the Pope. Why don't you charge these people? I said, everybody comes to you for your wisdom and everything else. I said, and I asked him one time, I said, Coach, as smart as you were, did you ever think about being a president of the United States? And he looked at me and said, nobody in their right mind wants to be president.
That's Coach, man. Look, man, we got to end it on that, man. Have a great afternoon. We appreciate you coming by to here, District, man. And we got to get you back on here and talk.
Thank you for having me. This has been wonderful.
I love you, man. Tony Spino, here, District. Appreciate you.
This has been a Bucks Plus audio production.